So, should we begin? It's the last session this afternoon, and I will wish you very welcome to listen to a very interesting topic, which is attack vectors. An attack vector is based on the possibilities to exploit systems vulnerability, be it through security holes or by social engineering. A defense that is effective today may not remain effective tomorrow, since the attackers are constantly improving or updating attack vectors, as well as looking for new ones. So to some extent, firewalls are helping, virus software are helping, but no protection, as you know, is totally attack-proof. So I am very pleased to introduce to you Danny McPherson, who currently is leading various science research and development efforts in the areas of network security and availability. He's also an appointed member of the Internet Architecture Board, the IAB, as well as the ICANN's SSAB, which is the Security and Stability Advisory Board of ICANN. And he's running, as far as I know, the L3 VPN working group in the IETF. Is that correct? Okay. So, welcome, Danny, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Emery. All right. So, good afternoon. I'm not sure. How many folks in the room were in the keynote this morning? Ah, good. Most of you. So you're going to see some redundancy here in some of these slides. I will make it a point to touch on other angles of some of that. About, I don't know, there's probably like 10 of the 40 slides or so here were used this morning, but I'll speak to them a little differently, and then we'll go from there. Since we do have more time, I was initially only going to have about 30 minutes or 45 minutes in the session, and then we were afforded more time. And so if you have questions during this discussion, by all means, raise your hand, and I'll be happy to take them immediately, okay? So anyway, I'm going to talk about mostly internet infrastructure threats. I'm talking about a few things, actually. I'm not going to talk much about sort of malcode analysis and those sorts of things, although if we want to talk about, you know, malware, botnets, or so forth, in detail, or botnet command and control, or mitigation tactics and whatnot, we can certainly talk to that later in the session. But some of the things I'm going to cover, which again have a lot to do with infrastructure in this thread, are IPv4 and IP, or so an IP architecture primer again, which many of you saw this morning, and I'll hopefully take a little different angle and focus a little more on IPv6 and some of the challenges and why it's going to be really important that that you're paying attention from both a security and stability perspective. And then the routing security and resource PKI. I'm going to talk a good bit about that and talk about some of the challenges and why it may be problematic. Well, why it's certain to be problematic as things progress. And then talk about DNS and DNSSEC and the DNS attack surface, the entire DNS attack surface, not just the operational infrastructure part. Then finally, some of the internet security and threat landscape, some of the things that that lots of folks see every day. So yeah, I've been at VeriSign, as I mentioned, for on the order of 5 months now. And before that, I worked for a company called Arbor Networks for about 7.5 years and spent a lot of time chasing botnets and putting out fires and doing a lot of missile defense stuff on the network side, where it was mainly aimed at mitigating attacks and then trying to get more reactive and then more proactive on the countermeasure side. So we're going to talk some about that. So anyway, that said, so I talked about some of this earlier, and it's important you understand some of the sort of IP primitives, I guess, if you will, and consider the fact that the internet's basically a network of networks, and a lot of these networks are multinational, right? And they're loosely interconnected, and there's no single authority, and that leads to lots of challenges, in particular from a security or an incident coordination perspective, a data sharing perspective, a privacy perspective, and certainly an incident response perspective in respect to if you find some malicious event or a botnet or compromised host or a phishing site or a drop site or whatever the type of activity is, what action you take may just be local to your network, and other people may take other actions that are in complete contrast with one another, and there's no real coordination among those, and that is problematic. So talk a little bit more about that as well. And then the fact that the sort of ultimate goal of IP was, when IP was designed for the ARPANET in 78 or so, I guess, was sort of the initial incarnation. It was meant to be resilient, a resilient communications platform that employs, varying underlying network fabrics and, provides any-to-any end-to-end connectivity. And that's exactly, as I said this morning, what IP does. Now, the challenge today is that you got all these higher layer protocols that are hierarchical in nature, like DNS is the first, and, you know, certificate status stuff, and where's the content set, and so forth. And the fact that those things are hierarchical or may not be local access or locally accessible resources, you know, are problematic, and, you know, in the sense that they create security challenges oftentimes, or availability challenges. We're going to talk some more about that. And, you know, then what I touched on earlier is sort of very, very generally speaking, the DNS is sort of the name is what we seek. A lot of times, you know, it's sort of a navigation anchor, something to that effect, like a domain name or URI, URL, you know, something that you're looking for, some search query and so forth. And then the IP address is the identifier and the locator. So this is one of the things interesting. I don't know how many of you have followed sort of next generation internet addressing techniques, but today an IP address serves as both a locator, it's where you are, and an identifier, it's who you are, right? And that's problematic because if you change your address, and like me, if I go to a new location, then the entire system has to know that Danny changed his address and here's his new address, not Danny's at this new address. There's a lot of work that's going on right now in something called locator ID split protocols. And basically the notion is that you decouple the idea of the identifier, the person or the in-system identifier from the location. And so if you could think about this, say you got a military network or something to that effect, or a big event like Olympics, or, you know, an aircraft carrier with a million IP address devices on it, and then it pulls up to port somewhere, and they all go in different directions, right? Then, you know, you would have the locator would remain constant, but the identifiers of all those different devices would show up behind other locators. So some ways you may end up splitting it. With IPv4 and IPv6, it's important to remember that today the locator and the identifier are the same thing on the network. And then finally, I'm going to talk some more about the security primitives this enables, a little more than I did this morning anyway, about, you know, topologically localized threats. The internet's a network of networks. IP, the reachability aspects, like the routing aspect and so forth, allow you to topologically scope announcements or target attacks. And so I could hijack a route, for example, just inside of a specific network. Or I could poison a DNS recursive name server in one specific network. And the owners of that domain or other folks may have no visibility to the fact that that occurred. So if you're not monitoring some of these things from a global distributed nature, then you may never see that those attacks occurred in the first place. And then finally, the asymmetry of threats and complexity of attribution. Again, as I talked about this morning, the fact that, you know, from a miscreant or a malicious, you know, sort of perspective, take cybercrime, it's much, much simpler to, you know, to download some code and steal somebody's wallet or their credentials, you know, when they're, you know, on another continent, right? And so you could get their credentials and their credit card or financial information, and they may be a half a world away, right? And there's much, much less risk in that than there is in trying to lift someone's wallet on a subway, for example, right? And so it kind of anonymizes the threat, and it allows, again, individuals to sort of project power internationally, just like it would any sort of nation state, for example. So it is a leveler, if you will, creates some equilibrium to that effect. So anyway, this is the layered model that I talked about. I think most of the folks were in the room this morning. I'm not going to go into great detail on this. I'll focus on some other areas. But what I'll highlight is, again, you know, with the IP model, right, if you consider the cloud, basically the two middle routers there, the more sophistication you put in those, the more complex the network becomes, the more expensive those devices become, the more gated innovation is, right? The whole notion of IP is like, hey, I want a dumb network that scales really well and provides sort of resilient connectivity between end systems that want to communicate and make the end system smart. And that's worked really well for IP so far. IPv4 and IPv6 sort of employ the same model. As you'll see in a moment, though, IPv4 and IPv6 both run at the network layer, and they're not compatible, and so they would both be two parallel network layers, sort of like ships in the night, if you will, passing one another. They don't know that they exist, and that's problematic in and of itself, and we'll talk about that. Some other things here, IPv4 was designed about 30 years ago, and 4 billion addresses seemed like a reasonable number, right? And so, yeah, it was at the time, I guess. But now that we've got 7 billion people on the planet and the Internet's a global network, 4 billion addresses isn't even enough for each individual, right? And so that's been challenging, hence IPv6, which I'm going to talk some more about, like I said. OK, Okay, so this is the thing I talked about this morning. If you look at even 10 years ago, most big carriers, big facilities-based carriers, had a discrete network for frame relay and for Ethernet and for X25 and for TDM and for voice and for video and for IP or internet connectivity. And all those were in silos, and it was expensive, and they didn't have all the services in all the markets, and they had to deploy gear, capital in the network in parallel in each of those. And today what you see is actually a lot of those networks have a lot of those networks have actually been adapted or converged onto IP or IP MPLS infrastructure. And so one example is something called pseudo-wires. I don't know how many folks in the room know what a pseudo-wire is. So I see a few hands. So basically all that you do is, if you look at that layered model from earlier, we go back to this previous slide. All that you do with the pseudo wire is you take something like a link layer technology, like say maybe Ethernet or voice over IP or TDM, right? Maybe it's a T1 or an E1, or maybe it's a SONET, like an OC3 or STM1, something like that. And you basically just jack it up, and you packetize it, and you put it on an IP network layer, and you carry it on the network, right? So now you don't know necessarily what the physical layer plan is, because you're carrying that stuff over an IP network as well, and it gives you much more reachability than you had initially. It's just that you now got these sort of layering violations where you're taking lower layer protocols and putting them in higher layer stuff. And when you do that, the protocols that you jack up now have a security attack surface of everything that's below them as well. So it can be problematic. We'll talk some more about that. So anyway, this diagram on the right is referred to as the thin waist of the IP hourglass, right? This is what you saw this morning when we talked about the end-to-end. And the thin waist is IP, and you've got sort of link layer technologies like Ethernet and PPP and so forth. And then on the network access side, that might be copper or fiber or radio or something to that effect. And then up here, you got things like pseudo wires or L2 VPNs or L3 VPNs, or your typical applications like DNS or email or even routing protocols and so forth would be applications or at the application layer. When you adapt these, I guess, one of the key things is that if I take Ethernet and I put it up over IP, it still has to emulate all the essential attributes of Ethernet. So if there are things that Ethernet requires end-to-end or so forth, or from a timing or collision perspective, I still have to provide that kind of capability. All right, so before I go too far into this, the three pillars of information security, if you will, right? It's pretty common, to see it split out this way. And basically what you have is confidentiality. Is it secret, right? Is it someone's personally identifiable information? If it is, you better encrypt it and make sure nobody sees it. It's actually what most of compliance deals with, is keeping things secret that should be secret and people shouldn't see. And so most of your IT security dollars, as a matter of fact, if you look at IT security spend, about 5 to 6% of IT spend goes to security, and about 80 to 90% of security IT security spend goes to compliance, and then the remaining 10% go to things like integrity and availability, which becomes problematic if you don't find other ways to invest in availability. So anyway, is it secret? Integrity is it authentic? Is it accurate? Is it what was input into the system? And then availability, is it reachable with acceptable performance bounds and so forth? So you saw this model this morning. Basically, the key trend here is, this is what you see. You had this hierarchy, and there were a few large ISPs, early on in the days of the Internet. I was at Internet MCI in 94, 95, and a lot of European traffic, even traffic between different European providers, came through the U.S., and certainly, international traffic from Asia and South Asia and Africa and so forth would come all the way back to the U.S. and then be exchanged inside the country. And now today what you see is, and actually Sweden was certainly one of the countries that forged the way here, is a lot of localization of content. At least the fabric's much more densely interconnected. ISPs inside of a given country or infrastructure will interconnect directly and not send their traffic to some place that doesn't need to see their traffic. And so in general, from a network fabric or denseness of interconnection perspective, that IP network is much more dense and much more resilient as a result of that. So that's a good thing. Refer to this as disintermediation, this term, sort of to borrow from the economist or, financial analyst sort of term. And basically what you're seeing a lot of is the content guys, the likes of Google or Facebook or Yahoo, and the eyeball folks, the broadband providers, are directly interconnecting. Why send traffic all the way up this link and this connection and then back down if we're in the same city, right? Why don't we just interconnect directly? The side effect of that, though, is that everything that you hand to this guy is probably going to some other region. It's probably not going to be exchanged here. So if you're an IP transit provider And IP transit's just been commoditized. It's dropped a couple of orders of magnitude in the last 10 years in the amount of revenue you can receive for that. But then the distance or the cost for you to deliver that content is much, much higher. So it becomes a very challenging market. All right. The other thing, I guess, is as networks interconnect more densely, the number of paths to reach a given destination, the number of destinations may stay the same or grow slightly, but the number of paths to reach any given destination may be much, much larger. And that's, you know, that creates security and, routing scalability and stability concerns as a result of that. What else do we want to say here? I think that's good on this slide. So this you saw this morning, the thing I mentioned was that, you know, Google, for example, had actually just moved up to number two. I just saw it on a bunch of news sites this morning, actually. I don't know if you guys saw that. And at times, their traffic accounts for as much as 12% of all internet traffic. And that's inclusive of YouTube and all the Google properties and so forth. But it's a lot of traffic from a company that just 2 years ago wasn't in the top 20. Right, and so that's pretty amazing. Comcast is a big broadband provider in the U.S., probably the biggest MSO in the U.S. And one of the things they started doing is because they had these huge asymmetries in traffic, is they said, you know, I've got all eyeballs on my network. Why don't I, so my traffic's very asymmetric. I send very small request packets, and I receive very large payloads back as a result of that. So there's huge asymmetries in ingress versus egress traffic. So what they decided to do is start hosting content providers, right? Put content providers on your network, and then you get more outbound traffic, and you don't have to invest in any new capacity. So it's a reasonably, it's a pretty optimal business model to step into that if you have these huge asymmetries in traffic. Hypergiants I mentioned, that's pretty good. So one of the things here, I guess, it's highlighting is the shared dependencies as well, is that if 30% of the traffic on the internet comes from just 30 organizations and you compromise one of those, the odds are that your average user has some interaction, at least on the back end through like Google AdSense or, you know, some sort of affiliate network, has at least one interaction with one of those 30 hypergiants every single time they go on the internet. And so if you could compromise a couple of those big networks, you get a really, and have some zero-day client-based, you know, browser vulnerability, get a really wide compromise base in short order or short time. All right, so I talked about this some this morning. I want to highlight a few other things here. The end of end-to-end, right? So, you know, IP is successful because everybody runs everything IP end-to-end. You pick your ports. You pick your protocols that run on top of IP. You do whatever you want, right? Well, everybody used to go to IANA, and they would get port numbers or protocol IDs, and they would, you know, design, say that then you could look at the envelope, and you say, oh, if the envelope's blue and it's using this TCP port, then it must be that protocol. Right. Well, today what everybody's doing is they're running everything over TCP port 80 because that's what works through a firewall. We were looking at this traffic actually when I was at Arbor, and we saw a huge drop in Xbox traffic. And basically what happened is Microsoft decided that because they got so many help desk phone calls because of firewall settings, that what they would do is they would run Xbox over TCP port 80 gaming traffic instead of running it on the discrete port that was allocated so that they wouldn't have to take those help desk phone calls because of firewall issues. The irony there again, this thing is, the irony there again is that most of the infections, the first people to move to client-side infections that work right through firewalls were the miscreants, right? So it's like all the compromised vectors. You know, the firewalls were put there 10 years ago when you had auto-propagating network-based threats, and everybody said, oh, well, I'm going to put a firewall there, and I'm going to block everything but TCP port 80. So the first thing that the miscreants did was, you know, launch all their attacks or the infection vectors over TCP port 80, right? And so everybody else stopped using protocols other than TCP port 80. So now if you want to do even basic things in the network, in that stack, in that dumb network, then you have to do application-level stuff. You can't just look at ports and protocols anymore. And so from a network engineering perspective, that's another challenge. Some other things here that may be interesting, certainly video. We've seen over this two and a half year time frame when we did this study, peer-to-peer traffic as a ratio, not an absolute percentage, but as a ratio of all internet traffic, dropped 70%. And one of the reasons why we believe that happened is because video traffic, either video on discrete ports or video over HTTP, saw a huge uptick in the amount of traffic over that same time frame. So basically, if people can go to a website and get something right here, right now, on demand, like I think Jeff pointed out this morning, why participate in a peer-to-peer network and share all this content and, you know, in global resource pooling when I can get exactly what I want, when I want it, for how long, and then go back to it later? So I think that's sort of what's driven some of the decline of peer-to-peer. At the same time, though, the folks that build peer-to-peer protocols have certainly done a better job of obfuscating. They've certainly moved some traffic over TCP port 80 as well, so I don't want to discount that. And then finally, your hourglass again. You know, there's your TCP port 80 and your thin waist of IP, right? So, all right. So internet growth has exceeded all expectations. I don't think we could argue with that at all, right? The address was actually just looked this morning, and you know, on an IPv4 address counter, and there I think there are 12/8. No, it wasn't quite that many. Basically, about 4% of the IPv4 free pool space is remaining now, and this is just a few weeks ago it was 5.5%, right? So it's going pretty quickly, and you know, when that's exhausted, there is no more. It's a finite resource, right? And so you have to go to IPv6, but IPv6 isn't on the wire compatible with IPv4, so if you want to communicate between the two, you have to have some translation function. And that translation function has to do things all the way up to the application layer and open packets and look at payloads, and it's not as simple as a standard IPv4 NAT, and so that becomes problematic. I'm going to talk some more about that in a minute. As I mentioned again this morning, IPv4 depletion or the address space and the exhaustion of that isn't a new problem. We knew about this 20 years ago and work began. Matter of fact, a couple of different types of work began. In the mid-90s, actually, in the mid-90s, one of the first things was removing classful boundaries, you know, sort of rigid allocation boundaries, class A, B, and C, for example, from the IPv4 addressing architecture. That was known as CIDR or classless. Another thing that people did as a short-term fix that's very, very prominent today is the introduction of NATs, or network address translators, that allow you to use a smaller number of perimeter at the perimeter of your network. You basically translate private addresses into public addresses for internet-facing services. And some folks perceive security benefit from that, you know, security through obscurity kind of model. And arguably, there may be some, but it compromised end-to-end because you got a device in the network that's basically taking an envelope off of that datagram and putting a new envelope on as it traverses the network. So that can be problematic. In particular, when applications do things like encode network layer addresses in the application, like FTP or SIP or some of the other protocols that have done that. So another thing that emerged was RIPE NCC was actually one of the first regional internet registry, I think, and conservation policies, teaching network operators how to deploy addresses responsibly, how to do optimal aggregation and address allocation plans and so forth. So those were three sort of short-term things. At the same time, work on IPv6 or the next generation IP began. And IPv6 as we know it today was actually done before 2000. It was actually done in 98 or 99, I think, is when the work on IPv6 was complete. You look at IPv6 addresses as opposed to, say, the 4 billion addresses that you get from IPv4, you get 340 trillion, trillion, trillion addresses. So if you want to sort of visualize that, you know, think of a golf ball. And there's enough golf balls there in IPv6 address space to fill the volume of the moon, right? And so it's pretty large address space. And then finally, I guess, you know, the other thing I say here is that IPv6 wasn't at the time intended to be a radical solution. I'm going to talk some more about this in a minute, but it was conservative engineering. It's like, hey, here's a new protocol. Let's design this. Let's get everybody to deploy IPv6. And then when everybody's got it, we're going to turn off IPv4. And that seemed reasonable at the time, but in hindsight, it's like, look, nobody has an incentive to deploy IPv6, right? So I'm not going to deploy IPv6 today. Everything's fine with IPv4. And what they forgot, and there was a lot of hype around it when IPv6 was finished. And, you know, and a lot of people that are in this room paid attention, and certainly lots of other folks I've worked with, and said, well, didn't we hear about IPv4 depletion 10 years ago? This isn't really a problem now, is it? And it's like, well, now it is a problem because just as predicted, we're about to run out of address space, and now we don't have enough address space to utilize the dual-stack transition plan that we had planned, which I'm going to talk about in this slide, I think. Yeah. So basically, if you look at your protocol stack over here, if you recall the IPv4 one, we had a network layer there on that earlier slide. Now what we've got is we've got IPv4 or IPv6 at the network layer. So you have to be able to speak both of those if, you know, in an internet where there could be either, right? Because it's going to be a long time before there's an IPv6-only internet. And when I say a long time, probably on the order of 2 decades or more. And so it's going to be challenging. And if you think about it, you don't get that network effect of at the network layer like you get with applications or even at the lower layers in the sense that if you're one of the first people to go to IPv6 and there's no content on IPv6, liken that to speaking a new language, right? It's like, you know, the whole world is going to start speaking a new language and we're all going to agree on a common language. and you're going to be the first one to speak only the new language. It's like, who are you going to talk to, right? The only people you can talk to are the ones that speak both the old language and the new language. So you don't have much of an incentive to go speak the new language by yourself. So there's that network effect. And until everybody can speak the new language, you can't stop speaking the old language. And you're going to have some people that are always going to speak the old language, or IPv4 in this case. So it's really problematic. The dual stack transition plan, as I noted, is sort of best when there's lots of people speaking the old language and the new language. And that's the problem today, is that we don't have enough people that are going to speak the old language to convert to the new language. Hope that made sense. I may be rambling there. I don't know. So what else here? So interoperability and coexistence. So it's going to be a transitional coexistence. Here a lot of people say, oh, the migration to IPv6. It's like, look, it's going to be IPv6 deployment. And then we're going to have this transitional coexistence period of a very long time. And then eventually, you know, sometime long, you know, probably after I'm retired, we'll have IPv6 only. But it's going to be a long time. And if you think about it, you know, there are lots of network operators and carriers out there. For example, there's a big media service organization, big cable provider in the U.S. It's going to cost them $12 billion if they want to replace all their set-top boxes in the households, because you can't run an IPv6 stack in the hardware that's there. So you got to run a truck roll and replace all of these set-top boxes individually. And obviously, you know, demonstrating return on investment for that, it's like, are you crazy? Let's buy a few boxes for the network that do some address translation and screw end-to-end, right? Or let's buy address space from someone that has IPv4, which is going to be really problematic as well. What else do we want to say? All right, so to what other transition plans we had? You can kind of liken it to Y2K, except for one thing. In the Y2K, you basically took all two-digit year data, and you replaced it with four-digit year data. Basically, what we got to do with IPv4 and IPv6 is you have to take 32-bit addresses and 128-bit addresses and run them both, because people are going to want to speak one or both or either, and you got to provide translation between the two for some undetermined amount of time. So it's not black and white, and there's certainly not a flag day either. All right. So the original plan, as I noted, was dual stack. Everybody's going to run both IPv4 and IPv6 at the network layer. And the problem is that until everybody's running both, you can't really turn the old one off, and everyone's not going to run both, so it's a problem. There's no standard protocol for how to translate from IPv4 to IPv6. Basically, if you have an application, DNS, for example, right, is an application, and I put a 32-bit address in there, and I ask somebody, I basically ask somebody for an A record, which would be 32-bit response, right? Well, if it goes out and some middle device in the network translates that to IPv6 because all they have is IPv6 addresses, well, the DNS equivalent of IPv6 is a quad A record. So there's 128 bits. So you can't take 128 bits and put them in a 32-bit field. It just doesn't work, right? And so now you have to have some middle box manipulation function. So that middle box in the network that we're talking about that's only supposed to do dumb stuff and keep the network simple, now not only has to do data path functions, it's got to keep this control plane state and associate it with these data path functions. And so the network's getting much more complex. And your attack surface as a result of that becomes much, much wider. And we're going to talk some more about that in a minute. Let's see. What else do I want to say? Quad A whitelisting. Does anyone in here know what whitelisting is? A couple of hands. So this is actually a really big problem, right, is that when IPv6 was designed and the specs were written and host stacks were modified, they said, look, if you have an IPv6-enabled interface and an IPv4-enabled interface, prefer your IPv6-enabled interface. So what that meant to DNS is that meant that if I have this IPv6, all right, so I want to go to Google.com, www.google.com, and I look and I say, oh, I've got an IPv6-enabled interface, so I'm going to ask for that quad A record instead of an A record. So I send the query, and then I get a response back, and I get the quad A record because Google just added this, for example. And all of a sudden, I look at that IPv6 interface address I have, and it's like, it's only site local, or I don't have native IPv6 connectivity to Google. Excuse me, what happens? Well, things break when that happens, right? So what Google does, as a matter of fact, when Google added a quad A record to www.google.com, they lost 0.25% of their customer base, right? And so that was a huge deal to lose that connectivity, because those people couldn't reach them. They had V6-enabled interfaces on their local system, but they didn't have native V6 or any V6 connectivity to Google, and so that was a problem. At the same time that happens, if you're a big broadband provider, I know one broadband provider, that when Google did that, they got on the order of 50,000 help desk calls. And they said, hey, I can't reach Google, the internet's down, right? And the ISP is like, well, you know, what happened? I don't understand. And so it's really problematic for the ISP to diagnose, and they can't fix the problem. So they just answered the phone and lost profitability on that customer for a year by picking up the telephone and talking to them, but they can't fix the problem because Google had this Quad A record and they got V6 address enabled. And so what happens now is Google decides they're going to be like, well, I'm only going to send Quad A record responses to recursive name servers if they've been expressly enabled and I verified V6 connectivity to the subscribers that sat behind those. Then at the same time, the broadband providers might say, well, I'm not going to accept Quad A records from any authority servers unless I verify data path connectivity. So you get this partitioning function, right? And there's no way to really get past that. You get these islands or these fragmentations, and it becomes really problematic, obviously. So your incremental deployment plan that we wanted for IPv6, to prefer IPv6 if it's there, just cause a lot of breakage as a result. So, all right, what else I want to say? Anyway, so to get away from IPv6, I didn't mean to turn this into a heavy IPv6 talk, but, you know, IPv4 depletion is happening, so you definitely need to be looking at it. Its time frames are just as predicted. It shouldn't surprise anybody. And there's a lot of issues, so you should definitely be looking at it in your operational environment. Time frames, here's time frames. This is the allocation structure. I'm going to talk about this some more in the context of secure routing in just a minute, but sort of the root IANA here, and like I said, these numbers are at 4 right now, and, you know, this is like 192 million addresses remaining, something like that, just from, you know, from weeks ago. But IANA will be running out in about 8 months or so. They're out of IPv4 addresses, right? The RIRs subsequently thereafter, whenever they deplete their own pools, and then the ISPs. And when the first insight or ISP can't give address space to a customer on IPv4 because they're out is when it's going to be a really big problem. And that's probably within 12 to 18 months, so it's not long off. So switch gears. One of the interesting things is that up here in this address allocation infrastructure, there's no authoritative database on the Internet that tells you who owns what address space or who holds what number of resources, if you will. If you don't have that database, you can't secure the routing system. And the routing system, as noted earlier, is basically, you know, in the case of interdomain routing on the Internet, is BGP, or the Border Gateway Protocol. And what I use BGP for is I connect all these different networks. I loosely interconnect all these different networks all over the world. And I say, hey, here's the destinations I provide reachability to. And if they don't have this database, they really don't have any way to verify that what I'm telling them I provide reachability to, I actually provide reachability to. So the problem is that I could make a mistake, or I could leak a bunch of stuff, or I could try and hijack someone's route, and they don't have a way to authorize that. So without a database that says who holds what number of resources and sort of is aligned with this hierarchy, then you certainly can't secure BGP routing. So let's talk some more about that. So basically, this is what it kind of looks like in practice, right? You know, this routing by rumor thing is what I was saying, is that I tell someone some information. I say, you know, I assert reachability for a set of network layer destinations, IPv4 addresses or IPv6 addresses, and they receive that from me, and then they say, okay, I can use Danny or this AS to get to those destinations, right? Well, they either choose to believe me based on my trustworthiness, which they have no way to validate in reality, or not to believe me. And if they do believe me, they may choose to tell other people about that reachability. And so that's what I'm referring to when I say routing by rumor. So anyway, one of the problems is that this is the sort of the allocation infrastructure for Internet number resources today. And that red line right there is basically sort of a hard line that says everything below it's operational, and this is how routing on the Internet works. Everything above that line has no influence whatsoever on what's routed today. So a regional Internet registry gives address space to an operator, and that operator goes and they configure their routers and they tell everybody they know how to reach a given destination, right? Well, there's no tie-in whatsoever from what's allocated to what's below that line, right? So basically, the RIRs today are charged with managing resources that they have no operational control over. And so that obviously becomes problematic. It becomes really problematic if you tie it back to IPv6 and you say, well, if IPv6 and IPv4 aren't bits on the wire compatible and I can't get address space for my customer, why don't I just announce somebody else's address space? Or why don't I buy somebody's address space and announce it myself? So the RIRs, the folks that are up here in this allocation hierarchy, don't have any control over those resources. So absent that control, you know, the routing system becomes, you know, the Wild West, if you will, becomes really problematic. What else do I want to say here? That's pretty much it for that. So one of the challenges is that you know, the internet routing system, this routing by rumor thing is, you know, I'm trying to make it, you know, seem really, really insecure. It works reasonably well, but there have been lots of very prominent problems. Everything from route leaks to the internet routing table being deaggregated and announced to everyone, to hijacks, to, you know, to accidental leaks, to censorship type stuff being exported as a result of routing, you know, routing security issues, right? The interesting thing is that if you go back to this allocation hierarchy, and you contrast the routing system. The routing system is really loose and flexible, and it's set up between different peers on the internet. And this hierarchy is very strict, right? It's IANA at the top, and the RIRs, and the ISPs, and the insights. Well, if you end up overlaying this on the routing system, you now introduce new dependencies or new hierarchy on a routing system that was fairly autonomous, right? So depending on who controls these functions or what the allocation structures are, and if you have any intermediate capability to not directly employ that information. Basically, what you're doing is by securing the routing system, you're giving up some level of autonomy that exists today. So you have to find a way to balance that, right? Like, for example, if I'm any country in the world besides the U.S., I may not want a function with keys, for example, at the root of an allocation system that's held by a government, which, you know, in the case of IANA, it would be under ICANN as an operator function with oversight by the IB and so forth. But in practice, if you're any country besides the U.S., that's how you look at that, right? So the RIRs have to balance the goals of their constituents and say, how do we find security with this new database infrastructure that needs to exist, the resource certification hierarchy, And without imposing some new hierarchy that didn't exist before, some new infrastructure that could cause new dependencies in the system. So you're trading off some of the autonomy you had and introducing new dependencies to secure the routing system. But the reality is, if the routing system is not secure, then nothing above it's secure, period, right? And it's inherently insecure today. One of the things is the database infrastructure, I was talking about this resource certification infrastructure, provides essentially the registries, the regional internet registries, become title agents, right? They have certificates and they say these are your number resources and, you know, you're the holder of those resources and so forth. What else do we want to align here? So if you think the politics of DNSSEC are complex, DNS is an application that runs on an IP network, right? Think about the IP layer and you can realize how problematic that might be. All right, so this is just a diagram of the resource certification hierarchy and what it looks like. The reality is that IANA, in their capacity as the internet number allocation function, is aligned with the RIRs and would presumably at the end of the day will be the single root trust anchor in this hierarchy and give certificates to the RIRs for AS numbers and IP addresses, and then they'll sub allocate those. Pretty simple. All right, so you all saw this morning, right? It's pretty straightforward. I think you heard Curtis or others talking about this, but what most users sort of what my wife might view the internet as, for example, or my children, right? It's like a big disk drive right here. There's no shared dependencies. There's no autonomous routing system, and I don't have to reach out to five different networks to resolve Facebook, which is ultimately the desired transaction that I initiated with my web browser. It's just, a big disk drive right there. And so when something breaks, they call their ISP, and the ISP, if it's a sort of a global shared dependency, may or may not have the capability to resolve that problem for them. So let's talk about DNS for a bit. Pretty simple. It's like, what's a DNS attack surface look like? What's a DNS transaction look like? When my daughter wants to go to Facebook or example.com or whatever it is she's looking at, you basically say, all right, well, I need, my client. I fire my web browser. My web browser does a library call, and it says, I need to resolve www.example.com. So it sends a query to my recursive name server, my DNS resolver. My DNS resolver doesn't have it cached, so it sends something to the root, and it says, hey, root, can you tell me about www.example.com? And if it doesn't have an answer, which it probably shouldn't, it should give you a delegation or a referral to the TLD, in this case, .com. So then the resolver sends a query to the TLD, and the TLD sends a response back to the resolver and says, I don't know, but you can go ask example.com's authority name servers, and they'll give you the answer for www.example.com. And so he gets that, and he caches it. And then this blue thing happens, which was actually the user-desired transaction. So all eight of those packets, all four of those transactions were driven by one query to go here. Right, and most people on the internet don't realize that any of that stuff exists, and if any of those break, the entire chain's broken, right? The user desired activity. So anyway, when you look at this, you're like, You know, it's pretty simple. That's my DNS attack surface, right? But in reality, your DNS attack surface looks a lot more like that, right? It's, you know, the diagram that I just showed you is pretty much just inside of here, right? It's, you know, and other than like the root or the TLD servers that may exist here, right? It all starts with this guy up here with the registrant, right? The registrant's sort of the meat computer, the guy that goes in and he registers a domain and he manages the domain and authority servers. Actually, yeah, like right here, for example. So he's got two sets of passwords. He's got a set of passwords for that and a set of passwords for that. And if any of those passwords are compromised, it doesn't matter if you have a billion or, you know, $10 billion worth of capacity and terabits per second of transaction serving capacity. If these passwords right here are compromised and somebody changes something in that authority server, you're offline, right? You're broken. One of the funniest things that I see all the time, and I'm sure you should all go check this when you get back to your organization, is when you register a domain, you put an admin contact and tech contact and administrative contact, administrative technical and billing contact typically, right? And most people make that contact something within, say, example.com, right? So this guy makes it within example.com. So then his domain gets hijacked. So he gets some malware on his system, or he clicks on a phishing site, or his credentials are in some ways compromised, or somebody compromises the email account and clicks on a link on the registrar site and says, send me a new password, and the registrar site sends them a new password. The people that hacked the email account have the new password now, so they log on, and they change it. They hijack the domain. And when they hijack the domain, they send it to a drive, you know, make it a drive-by download site, or they try and completely jack it because they want to transfer it to another registry and sell it. Whatever happens, it doesn't really matter. But when the registrant, when this guy realizes it's hijacked, what's he do? Anybody know what he does? Anyone? Come on, all these people. I see a couple of heads. So basically what he does, he pulls up his web browser, he goes to his registrar site, and he says, send me a new password, all right? And who's the tech and the admin and the billing contact? It's hostmaster or, you know, registrant at example.com. Well, example.com is what was hijacked, so he's not going to get the email, right? And, you know, whoever hijacked the domain probably just completely nixed the mail exchange records anyway. So if you don't think about that simple thing, I've seen probably 100 domain hijacks in the last couple of years, and 95% of them had the administrative billing and technical contacts for the zone within the zone. And the problem is when the zone's gone, you can't use that contact information to recover the zone. So if you don't think about that sort of a priori, then you're going to have lots of problems as a result. Some other examples, let's see, the registrar resale. So this is actually kind of interesting, is sort of see, like I showed you the graph of over time, content getting much more consolidated, right? Basically, these niche players, either because of economies of scale or because they're really dominant in their market, and, you know, in that case, it's, you know, the likes of Google or Facebook or someone. But in the DNS space, it's similar, right? There are sort of two really dense clusters of people that provide authoritative DNS services. It's registrars that bundle it and provide web services and other things for their registrants. And it's people that provide sort of high-value or niche-market DNS authority services, right? So down here you've got sort of consumer, retail, you know, low-end, down-market, I should say, DNS services. And you get lots and lots of those. So from the registrar side directly to drive and provide authoritative DNS service. Then on the higher end, you get people that either really care about their DNS and they need it to be available and widely distributed, so they partner with, say, a registry operator or someone to provide their DNS service. Or you get someone that gets attacked all the time, because DNS is probably the weakest link, right? You probably don't have as much DNS capacity as you have transaction serving capacity, and the miscreants, the attackers know this, so they attack your DNS instead of attacking your website, because they know if your DNS doesn't work, your website doesn't work, right? So the people that get DNS attacked a lot decide they're going to buy these high-value DNS services, right? So what you end up with is these really dense clusters. You got down here the registrar one, and lots and lots of authority services, and then this other cluster. Then what happens? What happens is that those people still get attacked. So the higher the density of that sort of multi-tenant infrastructure, the more clients they have on there, the higher the probability of someone receiving an attack, right, receiving DDoS attack. When people launch DDoS attacks, they don't launch, 500 megabits per second. We see attacks that are 50 gigabits per second, right? And it's not 50 gigabits per second of bandwidth you have to have to deal with the 50 gigabit per second attack. It's 50 gigabits per second of transaction serving capacity for whatever the service is running on the target port and protocol, right? So you have to be able to field 50 gigabits per second worth queries to mitigate that. And most people in the world can't do that. So not only is the target taken offline, collateral damage, and everybody else in that dense cluster on that authoritative DNS provider is taken offline. You see this all the time. Then if you think about the top right cluster, the people that buy these services because they want them to be highly available, what happens is the people that bought those services because they get attacked, and it takes not only them offline, but it takes all the other adjacent folks offline as a result of collateral damage as well. So it becomes really problematic. So you're buying these services because you want highly available DNS, yet you're on the same infrastructure as people who get attacked all the time, and so they get attacked and it takes everyone offline. So we've seen multiple examples of this. You guys can probably infer from press outages and so forth. Some other things here, you got all these consumer handsets, you got your recursive name servers. One of the interesting things here is traditionally recursive name servers, the ISP or the enterprise, sysadmin, whoever, provided the recursive DNS. Today what you see is, likes of Google, for example, has an open recursive name server over here, and Open DNS has one over here, and somebody else has one here. So when this consumer can't resolve something and they call the ISP doesn't know whose DNS resolver they're using now. And so the internet might be working, but DNS isn't working. And so it looks like it's the ISP's fault, when the reality is that the end system may have used somebody else's DNS resolver. So it's a dependency that may not exist on net. And if you don't have the capability to identify which DNS servers they're using, or to make sure that you have failover for DNS recursive name servers, then that can be problematic. Another thing that's really interesting there is a lot of people might they use DNS as a policy function, and I'll talk some more about that in a minute. But they might say, look, this user's buying parental controls, and so they can't resolve any of these DNS names or these child pornography sites or whatever it is that they can't resolve, right? Well, the daughter that had parental controls and couldn't get to Facebook after 10 o'clock because of a DNS policy downloads a browser, resets the DNS resolver on her on her system, and isn't using that DNS resolver at all, right? So that policy isn't even impacting her if she has her wits about her. So it could be really problematic from that perspective. There can actually be liability. One other thing you're seeing is you used to have a standard recursive name server here, and then on the end system you would have one specification. You would say, that's your DNS resolver. Now what you're seeing more of is people want policies for Wi-Fi versus 3G versus wired Ethernet, because there are different policy zones in the DNS. So you see a fragmentation in stub resolution functions on the end system. The other thing you can actually expect to see very soon, is applications that have their own DNS resolver embedded. Like, for example, Google has 8.8.8.8, their open resolver, and they build Chrome. And maybe they want to do some special things with DNS, so they can say, use our DNS resolver. So not only do you have system-level DNS resolver settings and multiple recursive name servers here, you have an application on the end system that has its own recursive name server specification. So when that breaks, who gets called, right? And when you call the ISP, is the ISP now asks you to say, oh, well, what version of browser are you using to determine if your DNS is broken or not, right? That could be really problematic, as you might imagine. One other thing here is, like, on the smart grid and Internet of Things, the DNS is something that's going to enable all those functions. You don't want to hard code IP addresses into that infrastructure. Now, there may be some closed networks, but there are lots of reasons why an air conditioning system might want to be shut down during some high draws on an electrical grid system, something to that effect, right? So smart grids and the capability to manage all these devices, say a toilet, you kind of laugh, but adjust a float valve reservoir when we're in drought conditions, right? Adjust how much water we use, those sorts of things. And it's going to be IP-based, and it's going to resolve on DNS. And if the DNS is compromised or you can't find integrity in that, like DNSSEC brings you, or it's not available, it could be a really big problem. So you need to look at that entire attack surface. All right, so DNS is multi-tenant. I already talked about this some, but it's really interesting when you look at DNS, because DNS is a hierarchical, distributed, multi-tenant infrastructure that in some areas it's hierarchical, like the root and the TLD levels, it's strict hierarchy. Then when you get to second-level domains, it's widely distributed. And when you get to recursive name servers, it's much, much more widely distributed, right? And so what you find is these clusters, again, that I was mentioning, and You know, and the more tenants, as I said, that you have on a given cluster or name server, the higher the probability of an attack. Same thing with cloud infrastructure, right? The more things you have, the more, you know, more individuals that you have on a given piece of infrastructure, the higher probability of either a compromise or an attack, just like any other sort of risk analysis model. What are we going to say here? So, see lots of attacks, right? You see, volumetric attacks are really, really large today. When people launch DDoS attacks, which I'll talk some more about in a moment, they don't say, you know, here's 500 meg. They say, I've got, you know, 1,000 bots or 1,000,000 bots, and I want them to attack that target. Flood them as much as you can. That's sort of the volumetric attack versus some very sophisticated attack vectors. For example, I go to an e-retail site, and I say, give me every product you have with an A in the description field. And all of a sudden, all their back-end load balancer state or all their database infrastructure with these three-phase commit functions and so forth is completely exhausted with one query. So if you don't have the capability to mitigate those sorts of query strings or to isolate that, then it could be really problematic, right? Natural densities, what else do we say here? All right, let's move on. So DNSSEC, zone management. So one of the things that we've seen, I actually got a chart here that I think. Yeah, there we go. So one of the things that you've seen over time, right, these are, I think if you can read this, this is basically quad A records in the DNS. This is the number of TLDs in the DNS over time. It's the number of name server resource records, so the number of name servers associated with a zone. And then down here you see this line is the number of quad A records or quad A resource records associated with the DNS. And we're just approaching the number of zones we have, but, you know, most of these are for a small set. Not all the TLDs even have quad A records in DNS today. And then finally, DNS resource records. But if you sort of step back and look, you're looking at IPv6 in this system that's been fairly stable for a long time. You're looking at RPKI and this routing security function that's going to impact the reachability on the infrastructure potentially. Then on the DNS alone, you're looking at new GTLDs and internationalized domain names and DNSSEC, which requires all kinds of extra overhead and key rollover capabilities and so forth. And IPv6, right? So all these combinatorial effects may create sort of the perfect storm, if you will, where there's all these changes to a system that's been fairly static for a while, and they're all coming within, you know, a very short time frame. And so, you know, we definitely have to pay attention to stability and security, and we definitely don't want these things to fragment the namespace or to fragment the internet in any manner. All right, what else we have? So DNSSEC adoption. DNSSEC really, you know, so the root was signed recently, right, which you all saw back in July, which was a lot of effort, and there have been a lot of domains that have been signed for a while, for example, .se. Some of the other domains are certainly on track to be signed, you know, relatively soon. The interesting thing with the recursive name server side is that, you know, you can't really just look at who's requesting DNS information. Matter of fact, about 50% of all the queries we get on our root name server infrastructure and we've received for years have been DNSSEC, requesting DNSSEC data because it's a matter of default behavior today. The only time that DNSSEC really matters is when people start using they configure recursive name servers to do validation, or they configure applications. Like a lot of the browsers, for example, have plugins today that pretty much every high-end browser, you know, the big four, for example, have plugins that allow you to do DNSSEC validation or at least see if a zone was DNSSEC enabled when it was signed. So if you have things like policies in the DNS, or you're doing NX domain mapping, or maybe there's some child porn thing, or whatever it is that you want to use DNS policy to mitigate a certain vector, those are going to fail if you're doing validation. So it's challenging for the ISPs to say, well, if I do this DNSSEC validation, I've got to give that up. And so that's a hit on revenue to get something that doesn't have a tangible return on investment on the business side. And so that's one of the inhibitors of some of the adoption of DNSSEC. Application level validation. I already talked about this. All right. So DNSSEC does bring integrity and authentication to DNS, which means that there are things you may put in DNS that you may not have put there absent integrity and authentication. And so I may talk about that a bit more in a little while. So systemic failures, right? Shared dependencies. Basically, if something, you know, the DNS is hierarchical, right? The internet number allocation function is hierarchical, and if there's an RPKI, it would have some influence on routability. If something messes up at the root of the namespace, or you can't reach any of the, however, you know, the 300 plus root name servers that exist, or at the TLD space, like some of the examples we saw where .se had a problem a couple of years ago with the zone edit and so forth. But if something happens in that hierarchy above you everything below that in that chain or on that branch is broken. There's nothing you can do, right? And when cache is timeout, it can be really problematic to recover. So you need capabilities, you know, if you're doing incident response planning or other things, to try and find some autonomy and alignment of that hierarchy. It's like, what do I do if .se doesn't resolve? We're highly, highly reliant on that. Everything under that TLD doesn't work if that doesn't work. And so that's why it's so important that, you know, that TLD operators invest heavily in infrastructure. I mean, you know, from the TLDs that, that VeriSign operates, I can tell you that if a big social network, for example, has an outage, we can see 4 or 5x the number of queries, right? I mean, we could go from X number of million queries to 5x that, right? And, you know, and the reason why is because people are saying they're clicking links and caches don't cache those things as long and so forth, right? And so we can't not have that capacity, right? If things break at that level in the hierarchy, it's extremely hard to recover from that. And so it could be really problematic. So it's important that if a TLD operator or root operators invest in overcapacity of this infrastructure to deal with flash crowds or very large attacks, because that hierarchical infrastructure, if it's unavailable, no user desired transaction is going to complete on the internet. Another thing with DNS, right, is it gives you integrity and authentication. But if you get garbage in, you get garbage out. Or if the credentials are compromised by the registrant and they modify the zone entry data and it's put in DNSSEC by the registrar and it's populated in the registry, then it's malicious data in the zone. And it may be signed and validatable, but it was garbage, right? And so, or malicious for that matter. Validated response equals truth and input. So one of the other things that DNSSEC people don't like so much, but basically all DNSSEC gives you is more ways to fail. Right, it's much more complex. It makes availability more challenging, but it gives you more ways to fail. What you do get is you get truth or knowledge in knowledge in truth of input if something validates. Otherwise, you get a failure. Right, so the system at the end of the day is going to be much more secure when we get this stuff rolled out. But until we deal with all the failure scenarios and get operational experience, it could be problematic. And we've certainly seen some remnants of that. We're getting much, much better at dealing with key, things like key rollover, expiry, and so forth in DNSSEC. Availability attack surface. So DNSSEC, if you have a recursive name server, uses, you know, nearly an order of magnitude more resources. For example, you have to build your chain of trust and generate a lot. You know, there's a lot more CPU-intensive functions that you have to perform on recursive name servers to enable DNSSEC. So not only are ISPs giving up some of the monetization capability they had to help people connect with confidence in the infrastructure with DNSSEC, they're also investing in more capacity or resources to do this. And it really doesn't benefit from that externality effect, right? So it is a challenge for people to enable that. The one word, I was in Curtis's talk this morning, and somebody asked him a question about ISPs and why would an ISP want to enable DNSSEC. And I can tell you that if I'm an ISP and, there are two or three things ISPs care about most, right? It's like average revenue per user is one of the top ones, right? Churn is one of the top ones. They don't want them to go away, right? One of the challenges is that if you don't enable DNSSEC and do validation and your customer starts using somebody else's recursive name server, an application level specified resolver, because you're not doing validation, you just lost a big piece of stickiness that you had to your customer, and it's a lot easier for them to go to somebody else's network, right? So you need to think about that aspect from a strategic perspective when you're weighing whether you should do DNSSEC or not. And then, you know, the combinatorial effects, this is the complexity in DNS I was talking about. This is DNS alone. This isn't the IPv6 and all the other functions I was mentioning outside of DNS. So protocol architecting, I'm just going to hit on a couple of things here. But basically, when you design a protocol, you want to avoid circular dependencies is the first thing. Circular dependency meaning, for example, if to make routing work, I have to reach a database via resolution of a host name to get a certificate to validate a route update, then I can't, basically I can't reach the DNS server because routing doesn't work, but I can't make routing work because DNS isn't resolving, right? You want to avoid circular dependencies of that nature when you architect protocols. Another big thing is layering violations. When you take a network layer address and you put it in an application, it's a layering violation, right? You're taking information from a network layer. So if you swap that envelope and that datagram at the network layer and you don't do something corresponding in the payload, something may break as a result of that. And, yeah, I mean, a prime example of layering violations are things like, I don't know, DNS per se, it's a signaling protocol, so it gets sort of a waiver with this. But basically, if you take those A records, that 32-bit address, and it's in DNS, and all of a sudden you swap something at the data, at the data path or network layer, then, in essence, it's sort of a layering violation, right? And you want to avoid layering violations in general. What else? All right, so one of the things is that if you think of like DNS cache poisoning attacks, for the most part, absent DNSSEC and the integrity verification of the payload or the object security that DNSSEC gives you, source port randomization was sort of the hack that everybody put in place when Kaminsky came out with his enhancements to DNS cache poisoning. And basically what it was, like, hey, at this tiny piece of the network layer, let's use these randomized source ports. The reality is the reason you could poison a cache and you needed that source port randomization is because you can't trust the source address of an IP packet at the network layer. Well, if you could fix the IP spoofing issue, you wouldn't have the higher layer issues that you had to hack with. But what you would do is you'd fix every other thing that rides on IP that makes assumptions about the authenticity of an IP address, right? So basically the point here is that anything that rides on top of this that makes assumptions about that IP source address is probably going to be vulnerable to attacks. You know, SMURF attacks, reflective amplification attacks, DNS cache poisoning, you know, third-party recon, all those things that you can do because you can spoof an IP address. So without that authoritative database of who holds what addresses, it's really hard to do anti-spoofing sort of globally and interdomain on the internet. And so to have that capability would enable network operators to mitigate a lot of higher layer attacks that employ IP address spoofing. What else do I want to say? So that's it for this slide. So I mentioned this morning, basically, got a lot of stuff, right? Over here is DNSSEC and integrity and certificates and so forth. And over here is, you know, monetization lies, right? And basically the crux of that is that a lot of the money's over here. It's not in telling the truth, right? It's in, you know, providing services that your subscribers may want, but it's not about preserving a unique global namespace. And one of the reasons the internet's been successful is because it had a unique global namespace and an IP fabric that provided any-to-any end-to-end connectivity. And as you get IPv4 and IPv6 on the fabric and you see things can't reach each other as easily and you fragment the namespace and you use recursive name servers for policy, you fragment more and more, and some of the success that you had is going to be hindered as a result of that. All right, so this slide I showed you this morning, basically what you're looking at again here is that, you know, this is from Symantec. This is the number of variants of malcode. The interesting thing with this slide is this year it's probably like one every 9 seconds, 10 seconds, something like that. And a lot of these are the exact same exploits, and they're exploiting the exact same vulnerabilities. They just use either polymorphism, like, for example, they'll change the binary signature of a piece of exploit code or a piece of malcode, or they'll use packers. So what they'll do is, like, gzip it, and then gzip it again, and then gzip it again. And when they do that, it looks different to IDSs, and so you can't do string matching in antivirus software or IDSs. So that's basically why, on average, 50 to 60% of the time, your antivirus software will catch a piece of malcode that's less than 2 weeks old. It's not great odds, right? You'd like it to be better than that. Client-side vulnerabilities was the other point here, which is most of the compromise today, it's not auto-propagating noisy threats. When somebody compromised your end system, you know, 10 years ago, it was like stealing a car they wanted to take for a joyride, you know, a kid might do. Today, it's more like a chop shop, right? They want to put a keylogger on it, and they want to use it for spam relay and or set up as a botnet CNC or click fraud or use it as DDoS bot or, you know, a drop site for, you know, or a botnet or a malcode distribution site. I mean, any of a huge array of primarily financially motivated actions that they want to use that that compromised digital asset for. And so they don't want to be detected. And so what they do is they say, oh, here's this JavaScript vulnerability or some iframe insertion with drive-by download for 0 day. And so they compromise your system. They don't want you to detect them. So it works. You know, it's not going to be really noisy from the network layer. It's going to be compromised through a legitimate client, you know, client-driven transaction. And then it's going to find a command and control infrastructure somewhere on the back end to allow the miscreant to take control of the system and further instruct it. So what have we seen along those lines? You know, some of the things, certainly the proliferation of compromised end systems. If I had to venture a guess, I'd say anywhere from 15 to 25% of the hosts on the internet at least are compromised today. And, you know, and with good reason, right? If the protections that we have out there only protect us, you know, best case, you know, 60, 70% of the time, then, you know, you're going to have a lot of compromised systems. Auto-propagating threats. It used to be network-based worms, and they were really noisy and really easy to detect and, you know, sort of defeated the purpose of monetizing those compromised assets. Instead, you know, allowed some miscreant to thump his chest or you know, drive his ego a little to people saying, hey, you know, I'm going to compromise end systems to find a way to monetize this. And I could do that from all the way across the world, you know, get access to somebody's credentials and financial information and extract money from them in some manner. Now you see all the time things like candy drops. Someone will put malicious software on a USB stick and drop them at an airport, right? Drop a handful of them. They're a couple of pennies each that they bought with someone else's stolen credit card information. They put malcode on it, and then someone says, oh, I found a USB stick. Let me add this. Plug it in their laptop, and boom, that system's owned, right? And so a lot of military computers and government computers in various countries get owned that way, is by what we call candy drops, right? So what else here? DNS is commonly used for command and control infrastructure. If you compromise an end system and you want it to call back to command and control infrastructure, it's a fixed IP address. Then when people discover that malcode for the first time, what are they going to do? It's like, oh, let's black hole that IP address on our network. So instead, let's use DNS. And then they use one DNS name and they can change the IP address. Then they say, well, you know what? When they find that DNS name and they write policy on the recursive name server, they break it. So why don't we auto-generate DNS names? Let's do 10 a day in one TLD. And then it's like, oh, they're blocking us. Let's do 50 a day in 10 TLDs. You know what? Let's do 500 a day in 100 TLDs, right? It doesn't cost them anything to do this. And so, so they're getting more and more sophisticated. Some other command and control infrastructures you commonly see are, it used to be traditionally somebody would use like IRC in a fixed connection. So they compromise an end system, and that end system would open up an IRC connection to an IRC server, and it would listen, and then it would accept the commands and do whatever it was ordered to do. Then you saw HTTP based, like they would go to a web page or they would connect to a port and do a GET and pull their commands down. Nowadays you see all the like Conficker and Storm and some of the other more resilient botnets, but even see Twitter and base64 encoded comments on a blog site, for example, that are used for botnet CNC. So that's very common, and you can't take Facebook or Twitter down inside your organization. It may be really problematic. So how do you sort of a priori identify and filter those strings can be really problematic. What else here? Registrant compromise. So on the registrant side, one of the common things that happens is someone will go to some registrant, or they'll do a whois query for a bunch of domains and find the admin contact, and they know who the registrar is. So they send them a query, say, hey, I'm your registrar, here's what a message looks like. They can even get a domain and copy the exact message and just change some links. Say, click on this link and change your password because something happened. So they click on the link, change the password, and the whole zone's hijacked, which means that everything to the right of it in that operational diagram is gone, right? And it's because of a single password. So that single-use password stuff is, if you haven't looked at your own zones and for some multi-factor or at least token-based passwords, then you probably want to be looking at that for all the access to your managed DNS services and for your registrars. This is from a survey that Arbor does. I actually did it when I was there, and they're continuing to do this, the Infrastructure Security Survey. This is attack scale growth of DDoS attacks over the last 7 or 8 years. Basically, last year, a 49 gigabit per second attack was reported. They've actually seen larger attacks than that. We've seen larger attacks than that. But the interesting thing is the fastest discrete IP backbone links on the internet today are more or less, typically 10 gigabits per second. So this is five times the capacity of the fastest discrete links on the internet today. So when somebody hits the, hits the go button and says attack this target with, you could launch a 50 gigabit per second attack with probably a couple thousand hosts pretty easily, right? And, and by any measure, there are millions and millions of compromised hosts on the internet. It's not hard to get a couple of thousand bots on a common botnet to attack someone. And so, all right, good. I got my time here. So hang on. Is that 10 minutes total?
Before we start a question.
Oh, okay, good. I wanted to make sure I had time for Q&A. All right. So anyway, 50 gigabits per second is probably gated more by the absorption capacity of the target and what they can measure than it is the firepower of the botnets themselves, and that's a pretty bad place to be in, right? The other thing on the sophistication side, see a lot of attacks that are discreetly aimed, like, for example, the query attack where they would say, give me everything in your database with an A in the description field, and it would completely exhaust back in load balancer state, or some search string where would exhaust some internal state on a system or some database state, or dictionary attacks on DNS resolvers, for example, that require some back-end caching infrastructure to populate something. So one packet in is three back-end transactions, right, that sort of thing. So those are really problematic in operational infrastructure. So you have to have the capability to mitigate those attacks at the application layer based on source or query type or string. So basically what I'm saying is you have to have the capability inside the network to do application layer things because they're a device in your network that are doing state-based things in the network, and you're violating that end-to-end model is what you're basically doing. So you can see how that'd be problematic. And those devices are expensive, and it's a challenge because when you get these large attacks, it's not about 50 gigabits per second of bandwidth you have to have. Again, like I said, it's 50 gigabits per second of transaction serving capacity for whatever service it is that's being attacked, and that could be really problematic. Collateral damage. So there's two places you really get collateral damage. One is sort of the trajectory of the attack, like, you know, somebody getting 50 gigabits per second of attack traffic and they have a gig E to the internet. Obviously, they can't absorb all that. And so on the internet side, so this isn't a great diagram here, unfortunately, but, you know, on the network side, if the target's over here and then this is the ISP and you get a bunch of attack sources from the left, then this guy becomes collateral damage as well, and other customers on his network may be affected, and so that can be a problem. One of the other things I didn't mention with IP already, but in IP, unlike an SS7 network or some of the legacy network infrastructures that we know, the control traffic and the data traffic, the user data traffic, share the same data path. So they're on the same links, going into the same packet buffers and so forth. So if that link's full, the routing sessions will go down. And if the routing sessions go down, all the reachability information is withdrawn, and everybody that was behind that is impacted. So that can be really problematic. The other thing is there's nothing this target can do if 50 gig or 2 gig of traffic's trying to go down that gig E. He's got to work with his upstream provider. So he really needs to have that information before he gets attacked on how to reach his provider. He can't expect to have an internet directory service, something to that effect, to be able to call his provider. Okay, so miscreants know the DNS is basically, if you got a terabit per second of content distribution capacity, you probably don't have a terabit per second of DNS transaction serving capacity. So attack the DNS, right? Attack the registrar, attack the authoritative DNS, right? Heck, attack the TLD, and that's what we commonly see. That's why the people that operate that infrastructure have to have capacity and capability to mitigate and absorb very, very large attacks. And if they don't, then everything below that in the hierarchy could be impacted as a result. DNSSEC, like I said, introduces more complexity, so it can be problematic and impact availability. It means that attacks are harder to mitigate and so forth. Tenant densities, I already talked about this. Actually, I've already covered most of this stuff. Let's move on. So compliance and security, I already talked about most of this as well, but can't say this enough. Just because you're compliant, compliance is really a waiver. I tried, you know, I did what, you know, what this checkbox said. Most of that stuff, like putting a firewall in front of your internet-facing properties, if you have a web server and that's the only thing there is in a data center, the only ports that should be running on that are the web port and whatever it is you use to manage it with only access from you. If you put a firewall, a state-based firewall in front of that, you probably have less capacity on the firewall to handle an attack than you have on the servers themselves, right? So that firewall you put there to be compliant just became the bottleneck from an attack surface perspective. So that can be problematic. What else? Let's move on. Cloud aspirations. So, you know, a lot of people talk about cloud, multi-tenant infrastructure, and economies of scale. The reality is if it's multi-tenant, then your attack surface is now the insider threat and attack surface that you had when you did this yourself, plus everybody else in that data path and at that cloud hosting provider's insider threat, right? Basically, everybody that works in that organization is now part of your insider threat scenario. And so you have to be able to identify and enumerate that. You know, the cleaning people and the power people and the wiring people and, you know, and the security people and everybody that works there is now part of your insider threat attack surface because they have physical access to those devices. So you definitely need to consider that. The other thing is that if for some reason your infrastructure is in the cloud or, you know, on somebody else's network, you've got more elements between your keyboard to where that content is, then your attack surface is bigger, right? If a DSL modem fails and now all of a sudden you can't access your email because it was on a web server in a cloud or, you know, on a mail server in a cloud, that could be problematic, right? That's not going to work, is it? All right, let me give you one more example here. So this is an example of, I made this name up for the country, right? Ashley's my daughter, and I just made up a country name. But anyway, if you consider someone that was under attack, let's just take a small country, and say they had 10 gigabits per second of internet capacity across, say, four OC48s or something like that. And they get DDoS attacked. And they say, well, you know what? It's like we do a lot of things online. So what we need to be able to do is, because we're getting hammered from the rest of the internet with this attack traffic, let's just shut those four connections off and bring everything back inside of our country online, and then we'll worry about the rest of the internet and getting things back online there, right? So it's like you nix those 4 1-gig connections. Well, what if you don't have a root name server, right? Well, when those caches time out, things are going to be broken, right? And then what if your ccTLD, for example, is hosted in another country? Then what do you do? It's like, well, everything's broken because you can't resolve those queries. And then what if those second-level domains, that managed DNS for whatever it is under that ccTLD or maybe a gTLD that people use inside the country doesn't resolve because it's hosted somewhere else and people can't access those servers? Now you got a problem because it's not going to resolve, right? And what's the first thing that everybody does for anti-spam checks with email today? They look up a pointer record, right? So when somebody connects to an SMTP port, it looks up, makes sure there's a pointer record that exists, a reverse DNS record. And if it doesn't resolve, a lot of times they'll deny the email transaction. So if you can't resolve that pointer record, email is not going to go through. Well, the ARPA, the inadder.arpa servers are over there, right? So I can't resolve that. Then you keep going. You're like, well, I need to verify, you know, what's the first thing that happens when a browser launches? It does a CRL download, right? It goes to the CAs that are listed in the browser, and it downloads this 800K file, at least, you know, from the traditional VeriSign side. And it says, here's the list of revocation list for certificates that we had issued, right? And then, you know, what's the OCSP, the certificate status protocol? So I query that, right? So basically what I'm getting at here is that if you don't have all those services available inside your country, you haven't given consideration to that from an autonomy perspective, or at least how you mitigate what threats, or maybe that's the only services you want to accept ingress. Then when you pull the switch or you try and segment yourself from something to respond to an incident, you're just going to break more things. So enumerating what those enabling transactions are before you have a problem is going to be much more beneficial than trying to do it after you've been attacked or after you've been hit. Operating global infrastructure, this one slide, I have like 2 more minutes on this, I think, right? 3 minutes, sorry? 2 minutes. Okay. So one of the interesting things, the internet's a network of networks, right? And the root server, some of you may have seen, a lot of countries do things with national policies, right, where they want to impose national policy, and it's completely at their purview, right, whatever they want to do. The problem is that when there are global hierarchical resources that the global internet community shares in this ecosystem, and some consumer of those resources may be using a resource that's in another country. If they're modifying the responses in some manner, then they're basically, you know, they could be exporting censorship or something to that effect. So it could be really problematic when you use DNS as a censorship mechanism. And so when you operate global infrastructure, you have to have ways to scope and prevent that kind of activity. And a lot's been learned about this in the last year or two. I'm sure many of you know, actually. And so it's another challenge we face when you have hierarchical systems that are multinational in sort of a global ecosystem of internet consumers. All right. I'm not going to go through this. Strings to SIG in. So I told you a lot of things about what was, why AV wasn't good and so forth. There are a lot of ways you can augment that. A lot of it's about reputation. So if a host does this and this and this, then it's probably compromised with that. I showed you those a new piece of malcode every 11 seconds. Well, you know, those 3 million pieces of malcode only had about 250 different vulnerabilities they were exploiting, and most of the network transactional behaviors were do A, then do B, and then do C. So do these three things within this time frame, and you're compromised. I mean, and we know they're compromised. So basically, applying reputation data, relational behavioral modeling, and statistical anomaly detection, you know, those sorts of things to augment AV is sort of a really good way to raise the bar in a reactive manner to protect against those sorts of threats. And finally, I talked about that earlier. All right, so the internet's always at an inflection point. The infrastructure that enables this, it's not always not always simple to invest in, and it's not always easy to demonstrate return on investment of, you know, for investments in that infrastructure. But it's absolutely critical. If you look at what enables your internet-facing resources, it's probably DNS and routing and IP reachability and number resources, and then where the consumers are coming from. So you definitely have to think about that when you're looking at the availability of the assets you care about most. So anyway, that's it for this piece. And multidisciplinary systemic approaches. Basically, when you look at that small DNS attack surface, right, and it's, you know, your client and your resolver and a couple of TLD servers, like, wait, what about the registrant? And what about the registry? And what about the registrar? And what about the managed DNS and so forth? So you have to consider all those elements when you look at the attack surface of anything that enables your networked business. So with that, I think we're ready for some questions here. And I don't know if we should try the audience first or if you want to ask first, however you want to manage this. It's all you.
Okay, first of all, we give you an applause for the speech and the speed.
Speed, okay.
As well as the speech. We have a organized for a sidekick to put up some interesting questions for Danny before I let you people know. So, Andreas from Roma, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Andreas, and I work for a small consulting company called Romob, and we do mostly security. And let's get started with the questions. You started talking about DNS security, and DNS security is a PKI model. And now VeriSign, I mean, I see lots of icons saying secured by VeriSign, and I see lots of certificates. I mean, we will probably not start buying certificates once we have that in the DNS infrastructure. Do you see this as a viable business model for the future?
Yes. So a lot of what you see for VeriSign is we did have a CA PKI business that we actually just sold off to Symantec. And that's certainly something in sort of their consumer-faced, consumer-facing services and product suite that they have that augments their business nicely. That said, there are certainly ways that if you have integrity and authentication in the DNS, you could use it to enable authentication or carriage of SSL certificates or other things. I certainly know that they're well aware of that, as are we and many people in the DNS community. And so, you can basically get rid of some of the overlay infrastructure and carry some of the certificates, for example, in the DNS protocol itself. So there are ways that by having DNSSEC and that infrastructure, you could have delegation capabilities and so forth. So. In short, I don't think their business is going away anytime soon, but I think that there are some neat new applications and capabilities that can be much more optimal if they employ sort of a DNS distribution mechanism.
Right. Another question on the subject of DNSSEC is that the next main speaker is Cecilia Malmström, and she's quite known in internet circles for pushing for this European central block list for websites. And that's being based on the same as the Swedish model, which is based on blocking domain names.
Yep.
And I don't think this will work quite well with DNS security. Because basically what you're doing is you're saying that, no, this domain does not exist on this IP address, this exists over here instead.
Right. So if DNSSEC brings integrity to DNS, and that's sort of the crux of that DNS frequency spectrum that I had there, where on one side there's integrity and on the other side there's, fabrication or lies, if you will. And if you modify the response, you use DNS, for example, as a policy function, then those would be DNSSEC validation failures if they were within signed zones and you were performing validation. Now, that said, the other challenge you have is that using DNSSEC as a policy, using DNS as a policy implementation function when applications could do their own DNS resolution across ports or protocols that may not be UDP 53, may even be encrypted, could be really problematic or may even present liabilities. If you think that by saying that my DNS resolver is only going to respond with this IP address of a black hole or a loopback or a portal or something for some malicious content, then an application says use this DNS resolver somewhere else in the world that doesn't have that policy set, that user, subscriber, or kid, or whatever it is we're looking at, now has access to whatever content.
Absolutely, and that's how it works today. But the trick is that you don't want to keep people who knows how this work out from that. You just want to keep the wide mass because you want to show that you are doing nothing about the problem.
Sure.
And this is not going to work if you have a DNS security. So either they will have to stop DNS security or they will have to stop with this rollout of a blacklist.
I understand. I understand. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to sort of get mass market. I mean, that's one of the things that lots of ISPs do today is the only capability they don't own the end systems, for example. So one of the primary ways that they mitigate botnets is they'll create a walled garden based on a DNS response and send someone to their portal and say, you're compromised, you can't go anywhere until you fix that. And if it was strict DNS with validation on those servers, they don't have that capability anymore. So they have to have some injection function to accommodate that. And if you do that, then you break the trust model and you break a unique global namespace. But, there are sort of practical realities that people have to deal with to offset, some of those sorts of challenges, I guess. So.
Right. You were earlier speaking about the slide about this application stack where you have this top-down model, the top-down pyramid where you have applications on top. And you go further down, you go down to the network layer, where the applications are the big attack surface. And what do you see as the mitigation to this problem?
So I think you're going to have to augment the binary signature matching or string-based matching with reputation is sort of what, what one of the latter slides I had in there talked about is that, you know, the fact that there's sort of a benefit in the fact that when people compromise an end system now, they want to use it for something, or they want to extract data from it, or exfiltrate something, or, you know, or have it attack something, because to do that, you have to control it. And so if you can identify or find mechanisms to identify the CNC function, or you can walled garden certain applications, say this is the only thing you can do to that application, you have that capability to, like, sandbox one of the things you were mentioning to me earlier, certain applications, then you can certainly have a higher security posture as a result of that.
Because the problem with using a signature-based security model is that if you can compromise an application, all you have to do is launch another thread within the application to do whatever you want, because
you
will soon be running in the same space.
You got it. Yep, absolutely.
Do we have a question from the audience? Someone? Or should we just let Andreas continue?
Ah, good. I got one.
Okay, we have one over there. Oh.
Hello, can you? Oh, that was loud. You mentioned in your slides that AVs, IDS, IPS, firewalls, they block something like 50 to 80% of the attacks, but they are all based on known attack models, known viruses, known vulnerabilities that someone has written an exploit for.
Yep, absolutely.
And what it leaves under the table and undetected, and something that the hacker world out there knows and utilizes all the time at the moment, is a level of, we call it unknown vulnerabilities. The bugs that exist in the softwares that the vendors don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
So have you discussed or have you addressed these unknown vulnerabilities some way? I mean, there are research indicating that these can be found, but to a certain extent. No software is 100% secure, but have you seen something like this?
To your point, I think one of the observations you made is that any of those mechanisms like IDSs and AVE and so forth are inherently reactive, right? It's like, hey, we saw this exploit, and this is the signature of it, and this is what either network transactions or payloads look like, and so you should block those because those are bad, right? And so what about unknown vulnerabilities? And there are a lot of things. Actually, one of the things Andreas was talking about earlier is, you know, there are ways you can sandbox, or, you know, everything you do should be ran in the lowest priority, you know, this sort of the principle of least privilege, for example, or, you know, make sure that applications or services or users and so forth don't have capability to do system level or administrative stuff. I mean, there are lots of things you can do, and lots of different products on the market today that try and be more proactive and more gating in what resources a given process might be able to obtain from a system. And coupling those with some, with a huge array of capability, I didn't want to dive a lot into that, but with a lot of other functions, does provide you some more proactive countermeasures or protections. But, that's the only way you're going to get ahead of it. Most of what we do today is inherently reactive for spam and bots and malcode and so forth. So
one last question, Omar.
Yes. You're talking about hijacked address space. As we're getting closer to the total depletion date, have you seen an increasing number of hijacked address space or leaks and so on that you can actually connect to? Are there some sort of sales that shouldn't have taken place, or that the black hat started using others' address
yes.
space?
So we've certainly seen, and there are a lot of people that are monitoring just that, right? They're basically saying, well, what's the frequency of, occurrence of a route hijack, for example, going to be when IPv4 address space is depleted, right? So, you know, the fact that there's no sort of resource holder, I can't tell who actually owns space, is very problematic. So we actually see spammers all the time today announce a subset of either BOGON space, unallocated space, or someone else's space, and send, you know, a billion spam messages and then withdraw it, right? And they even use the existing pointer records and all those things. It's really problematic for the people that own it. But on the side of sort of the black market or gray market for address trading that already exists today, and some of the RIRs putting policies in place to try and at least be more transparent about people trading addresses, and so everyone knows who holds what resources, I don't think we're going to see a huge uptick of people hijacking space for that purpose. I think we will see a lot more disputes about ownership of address space that may not have been used. I don't think, it's quite likely. I know there's a lot of research and stuff set up to monitor for just that question. Yeah. So,
because there's been some...
Because we don't want to miss Cecilia Malmström, I believe. Some of you are really waiting for the next session. So why don't you just continue tonight during the party of this next keynote session? And thank you very much, Andreas and Danny, for an interesting presentation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Oh. Andreas, there you are. Mm-hmm. And here's some for you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is that pretty good?
Oh, that's